This is Jen.
This is Kelsey.
And you're listening to the first 50 pages.
So Jen, I don't know about you, but a decade ago, I was on my college campus. I was a sophomore. The Hunger Games books and the Twilight books were being passed around from dorm room to dorm room. You know, the pressure of finals week and all that kind of stuff going on. So a lot's happened in the last 10 years.
Well, I'm a little older than you, Kelsey. 10 years ago, I started my career with the Sioux City Public Library. So this is actually, I've now worked at the library for a decade.
Wow.
I think this episode, we're going to talk about kind of some reflections on the last decade, but also some of those best books of the decade.
And definitely kind of some of those trends, you know, where books were 10 years ago to where they are now and kind of how we have evolved as readers and what we're interested in.
And I think it's really been an interesting journey for me to kind of look back on this decade because it's the time I've spent with the library. So it's been really a fun podcast for me to research and to look back on, because I'm not only looking back on the decade, I'm looking back on my time with the library.
And in preparing for this podcast, I was kind of like, do we want to start talking about, like, you know, what fashion trends were a decade ago and all that?
No.
And I was like, no, we're going to avoid that. Nobody needs to revisit those mistakes.
We're staying away from fashion. So in looking back at the 2010s, is that what we're calling them, the 2010s? Let's talk about some of those trends of the last decade related to books and publishing.
So diversity is a big one, and it's kind of, you know, has the wider variety or the push to have more diversity in books and publishing. Is that a result or a reaction to social media movements? What's going on in the world? Anything like that. So it's not super anything new. Readers and writers have talked about, you know, making space for marginalized voices in literature for a long time, with the goal that every reader can see themselves represented in books. But for the past few years, diversity in the publishing industry has been quite the hot topic, an inspiration for numerous initiatives, social media campaigns calling out for more representation in books.
In 2014, if we can all think back to that time, the We Need Diverse Books campaign was launched, and that was a hashtag, We Need Diverse Books. Since then, we have seen a growth in diverse representation in almost all areas of the publishing industry. Publishers, authors, readers, and reviewers all seem to be a little bit more vocal about the need for inclusivity across genres. But recent statistics show that we still have a long way to go to achieve this goal.
So a 2018 study out of the Cooperative Children's Book Center of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison found that the percentage of books depicting characters from diverse backgrounds is abysmally low. In 2018, more children's books that featured an animal main character were published than children's books featuring a Black, Latinx, Native, or Asian child.
And that was kind of shocking to me, but not really, because when we look at the books, you know, that are even available for us to purchase, we do have to make a concentrated effort to add diversity to our collection. And I think that we certainly are. You know, I know at the Sioux City Public Library, even at the Iowa Library Association, you know, diversity is that topic that we continue to talk about.
Yeah, I would definitely say it's something that we see at all conferences, you know, that there's a ton of webinars and continuing education about it, and kind of how can librarians best approach the issue and kind of really make sure that we're offering, you know, as much as we can for our patrons, you know, so that readers can really see themselves in the books that they're reading.
And when we think about why this is important, children's book author Crystal Swain Bates states it really well. She states that diverse books aren't just for the diverse, they're for all of us. Books can help build bridges of cultural understanding, they can promote tolerance, normalize identities unlike our own, and allow people to develop an appreciation for the culture of others.
And a key component of this is the rise of self-publishing. It's kind of really been a game changer when it comes to diversity and representation in the industry. Once considered taboo, self-publishing has really opened the door for authors to publish their own books under their own terms, without the need for an agent, a book deal, or the approval of a publishing company.
And while it's opened doors, self-publishing has opened doors for more diverse books to be published, those books can't be successfully sold without distribution. So it's important for the people making the purchasing decisions at bookstores, libraries, and beyond to be committed to building a diverse catalog of books that everyone can enjoy. I know these discussions are happening. Libraries are looking at their collections and really focusing on building diversity in their collection. So while, you know, it, like we said, this isn't anything necessarily that's new. You know, we've always tried, I think, as libraries to have books that will represent the community that we serve. I think it's something that's here to stay. I think that we'll continue to work towards
those goals.
Yeah, I think
we'll see a stronger push for it over the next decade, too.
I don't know about you, Kelsey, but honestly, I didn't know what a hashtag was at the beginning of the decade, but that could be like our age difference. You were probably using hashtags at the beginning of the decade. I had to learn what they were.
I'll say I'm a really, really bad older millennial, and I had no idea what they were. But Facebook was new to me in college. Like, everybody else had had one for a couple years.
But we all pretty much accept hashtags as a normal part of social media now. But if we look back at the beginning of the decade, not everyone was happy to use them in the beginning. Twitter actually told the person who wanted to bring hashtags, his name was Chris Messina. He was the first one to use hashtags on Twitter, as far as like history credits him for. You know, Twitter said it was too nerdy and would never catch on. And he had to fight for his hashtag plan and convince others of the benefits. And Chris has been quoted as saying that in the beginning, people really hated hashtags. People didn't understand why we needed hashtags, and the biggest complaint was that people just didn't like how they looked. He intended them to act as metadata for a tweet, so that's something to provide extra information about a tweet, like where you are, what event you're referring to. And I think, honestly, we can look back at the history of our decade in hashtags, which is so strange to me to think about. And I was looking back at some of those different hashtags that were used in the last decade. One of them, the We Need Diverse Books hashtag, but there were other ones. Bring Back Our Girls was one of the first and most widely spread one.
Yeah, there's hashtag Me Too, hashtag Love Wins, hashtag Ice Bucket Challenge. I don't know if you did that challenge, but...
I did too.
It
is in my social media history. It is.
It's back in our archives.
Yes. And then, of course, you know, Black Lives Matter, March for Our Lives, Own Voices. So political engagement and debate are occurring more frequently online. And hashtags quite literally have transformed online community unifiers into political movements and tangible organizations.
Yeah, no, definitely at the library, and even in our own social media, like, we'll use hashtags to really, you know, if people are searching hashtags on Facebook or Instagram or something, that if it's a certain author or a book, or, you know, what are you currently reading? It's another layer and another way for us to connect with our online patrons and our online community that we serve.
And I think there's still some people out there, you know, that maybe don't use hashtags or don't embrace hashtags, but there is definitely, I think, especially in a younger generation, the hashtag activism. That's a term coined by media outlets, which refers to the use of Twitter's hashtags for online activism. The term can also be used to refer to the act of showing support for a cause through a like, share, etc., on any social media platform, including Facebook and Twitter. They can be effective in the sense that they create solidarity to achieve a common goal, and an individual can start a movement without necessarily needing a crowd to kickstart the campaign.
And I know we even mentioned the hashtag, like, eBooks for All campaign in our last episode, that, you know, it's a way that people are able to stay up to date on what's going on.
So I think the hashtags are here to stay.
I think they are. I just have to get better about using them.
And it'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next decade.
Yes, they're going to be like a new hashtag. Can there be? I don't know.
No. I don't think you can talk about the 2010s, Kelsey, without talking about the rise of technology and how it has invaded our lives and really completely changed our world.
I mean, honestly, 10 years ago, I didn't think that we'd have, you know, like Alexa, where you could say, Alexa, play this song, or turn out my lights, or control your car from a smartphone, or control your security, anything like that.
Yes, we are definitely living in an age of the Internet of Things. Isn't that what you call it? The Internet of Things?
I think so.
I think that's right.
Let's roll with it.
If you've read The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, which I have never read in its entirety. The shame for that. But I think I'm going to put it on my list because I find this very interesting. There's a passage between two characters that goes like this. "How did you go bankrupt?" Bill asked. "Two ways," Mike said. "Gradually and then suddenly." And this passage has been adopted and often quoted by those who follow trends in technology. Small changes accumulate. At first you don't notice them, and suddenly the world is a different place. And I think that really sums up the last decade. Mm-hmm. Because 10 years ago, I didn't own a smartphone. They existed. I think the first iPhone was 2007, mm-hmm. and the first Kindle was 2007. The Sioux City Public Library started offering access to ebooks through a partnership with the Dubuque Public Library in 2008. Mm-hmm. And then the State Library started Wilbur, if listeners that have been around a while like me remember. And I think that was Western Iowa Libraries Building Online Resources. And so that partnership began in 2009. And then over the decade, we've seen Bridges, we've seen Libby develop. And in 2018, there were still billions of people that don't have a smartphone. But I think most of the people that we interact with on a daily basis have smartphones.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of the one-on-one tech consults that we do or a lot of phone calls that we get for help with technology, I would say an overwhelming majority is, I just got this phone, I don't know how to do it, or like, I don't know what apps are, or, you know, kind of still, there's that generation that I think is like one above me where like, if you haven't grown up with the technology, it's one of those things that maybe doesn't come as intuitively to you as it does, you know, my 5-year-old cousin knows how to work my phone better than I do.
And I think, you know, we always talk about the library as a learning organization, mm-hmm. meaning that we learn new things every day. And I think that's totally true with technology over mm-hmm. the last 10 years. We've had to learn new versions of smartphones. So not just how this works with the iPhone 5, but the iPhone 6 and 7 and Windows 10. And there have been so many rapid changes in technology.
Yeah, and all the different reading devices too, whether you have a Nook, a Kindle, an iPad, a tablet of some sort.
But I think one of the very cool things about libraries is we have evolved with technology over the last decade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we offer tech consultations. So if you need some help for figuring out your new device, call your library. We will help you try and figure some of those things out. It's not always easy for us, you know.
We might be learning right along with you at that time. But
we will work through it and try and help you figure things out.
Also, technology or those changes have also made materials more accessible for people. Now the fact that there are virtual libraries online that, you know, if you can't physically make it into the library, you still have access to our resources. You can still read online. You can learn a language online. Like, there's so many more opportunities.
And how we get our book recommendations has also changed. Mm-hmm. Goodreads, which I think most people who love reading probably have a Goodreads account. And the Goodreads Choice Awards, they started in 2009. And I think that's something that a lot of people look at every year to find out what readers like them are voting on for the best books in different genres. Mm-hmm. And NPR, their book concierge, started in 2012. Mm-hmm. So something that I think we also look at every year as like, what are, you know, those favorite best books of the year? Didn't start until this decade.
And selfishly, you know, we're going to plug it because they picked 3 of our Check It Out scripts to be included as part of this year's NPR Book Concierge. So we're going to continue to be on cloud 9 and feel like rock stars.
So cool. That was just the coolest moment, honestly, to see that we had 3 of them that they linked to our content on the Book Concierge. So,
yeah. So nothing's going to bring us down.
No. You know, it sets the bar high for us, you know, as we continue to do that. But we're going to keep working at it, right? Hopefully we'll have content for that next year too.
So now that we've kind of talked about technology, hashtags, kind of some other big, you know, trends of the decade. Now, of course, we have to dive into books. I mean, it wouldn't be a first 50 pages podcast episode if we didn't. So probably one of the biggest trends, if not the biggest trend
We've talked about it, even without like thinking about it as a trend of the decade. We've talked about it on this podcast before. I think we've mentioned it in several episodes because it does have such far-reaching effect on what is popular and what people are reading.
And even, you know, like how much of things are published, and it really just, I think, has informed kind of everything in the last decade with regards to books. And that would be the unreliable narrator,
aka Gone Girl, and the Gone Girl phenomenon. So why was Gone Girl such a hit? I think we have to really kind of dive in and think about that. Like, why did it just have this ripple effect into the publishing world for the last decade?
It's funny because it wasn't even her first book that she published. You know, she had Sharp Objects and Dark Places before that, you know, which were kind of standard mysteries. You know, they did fairly well. So expectations weren't extremely high for, you know, Gone Girl being her third book. But the week that it was published in 2012, it entered the New York Times bestseller list and ended up in the number one spot just a week later, selling around 2 million copies in the first year, outmatched only by 50 Shades of Grey and The Hunger Games.
In an interview with The Guardian, Gillian Flynn said that the story is relatable because of the push and pull of a long-term relationship, the little power plays and dynamics. And in Gone Girl, the sourness of the marriage between the protagonists is a very convincing account of a terrible relationship and one of the driving reasons for the book's success.
The story also explores, you know, the themes of class. Nick is from a Midwestern background and feels judged by his wealthy and sophisticated New Yorker wife, Amy. The story alternates between Nick and Amy narrating, but both are unreliable narrators, so there's no safe space for the reader. There's always a sense of risk, which is pretty compelling.
And what I remember about this book, so I have to confess, I have not read Gone Girl. But what I remember, I was working at the library when this book was all of the rage. And what I remember about this book is that readers didn't like it. They would come to the library and basically want to like throw the book at me. They didn't like the ending, but they wanted to talk about it. So I knew how the book ended. So it was like, I heard the spoilers every day, practically. They wanted to talk about the book. So I, you know, lended a sympathetic ear to listen why they didn't like the book. And I think one of the main reasons is there's no hero in the story. But Gillian Flynn says, if you are someone who reads books to feel like you have a friend on the page, my book is not going to be the book for you. I write for people who are readers the way I'm a reader. I don't care if I dislike a character. I care if I find them interesting, or if they make me laugh, or if I'm trying to figure them out. I'm always more interested in that.
I've never really thought about it like that, but I get it. I would say probably some of the most interesting books that I've read had characters that I hated, or I really didn't like, or like I would never be friends with that character. Why are they being so horrible?
And in that, in an article from The Guardian, Gillian Flynn said that she hoped that the success of Gone Girl would open the door to genre novels being taken more seriously. I think she nailed it. I don't think she could have predicted how it would have affected.
Yeah, that, you know, now we see over the last decade, or even, you know, since its publication, so many books that have girl in the title, so many books that have lady, or...
Yeah, Entertainment Weekly just declared the unreliable female narrator to be the biggest book trend of the decade. You had shared the article with me when we were talking about this, and it was really an interesting article. But yeah, some of those titles that kind of piggybacked on the success of Gone Girl.
Like Girl on the Train, Woman in the Window, Wife Between Us, The Silent Patient, Luckiest Girl Alive. These narrators aren't just unreliable, they're kind of truly unlikable. Which is, you know, what the Entertainment Weekly article asserts is a capital crime even now in the second decade of the 21st century. Part of the draw of these novels is that these female protagonists are allowed to be human in every messy, wildly imperfect sense of the word. They rage, they drink, they scheme, and sometimes they kill.
And while these books aren't all great literature, they do offer readers permission to empathize with extremes and to put ourselves inside the minds of characters we might not otherwise care to understand. In a recent interview, Gillian Flynn said, "It's dangerous to pretend women don't have anger." I agree. Because we all have our own unpretty thoughts. But I think in reading these novels, we get an opportunity to explore those thoughts and maybe understand them a little bit more. Plus, it's just a great chance to escape.
And I would definitely say, like, kind of the whole idea of the unreliable narrator, especially in the publishing world, like, I would say at least one out of every five books that, you know, we see in Booklist or Library Journal or, you know, wherever we're getting ideas to order books from, at least one out of every five has to be some sort of psychological suspense with some sort of unreliable narrator, some sort of intense, you know, female drama. They're everywhere.
And I think if you look at trends over decades, you can definitely see their influence. And I don't think that this is a trend that will stay. I think the pendulum is going to swing. We will leave our unreliable narrator stories. I don't know what the next trend is going to be. You know, it'll be interesting just to kind of pay attention to what people are reading. And that's one of the interesting parts of our job, is we kind of get to see those things, you know, in real life as they play out.
Yeah, kind of how they unfold firsthand.
Yeah. Certainly Where the Crawdads Sing. I saw like something online and it was like, if you didn't read Where the Crawdads Sing, did you even read a book in 2019? And I feel like that's how it is. Like everyone has felt the need to read this book. But I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know how it will affect the publishing world. But I feel like that's my prediction. But I don't know necessarily what.
Yeah, what that specific prediction is. But
yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I did read Where the in 2019.
I'll admit, since you admitted a secret, I have not read it yet. You know, like all of our patrons are reading and I don't want to take it away from them.
And I think with that book, one of the things that people say when they bring it in is they either really loved it, mm-hmm, or they were like, eh. You know, they're like, I don't know what the big deal was about the book. Or they're like, oh, it's one of my favorite books. So you're probably, if you're listening to this and you've read the book, you're probably in one of those two camps.
And that is like the fear, like when a book gets built up that much, like, is it going to live up to all this hype and expectation? So I don't know. It's on my list. I'm going to read it. Just hasn't happened yet.
You'll read it in the next decade.
Yes. So another kind of big trend in the publishing world was that, you know, there was like this fear that with the rise of ebooks and online resources, that print books would, you know, go away and that like libraries and bookstores would die. But really, since 2009, you know, kind of that state of publishing has been called into question year after year, with publishers embracing those digital formats. But really, you know, there's been kind of this renewed push for book buying and reading over the last decade. You know, still people are reading the same, like, you know, there's even maybe a little bit more readers, but, you know, kind of those numbers continue to stay steady, and really both formats are able to equally survive.
And I think only 20% of our overall checkouts at the Sioux City Public Library are in a digital format, so ebooks or audiobooks, which is a significant chunk, but that tells us that 80% of our checkouts are still coming from, you know, physical items in the library. And as more and more people embrace technology, I mean, you know, cars don't even have CD players anymore. So I find that to be an interesting change from the last decade. Like, if you get a new car, you have to specifically ask them
to put it's like a special order item now, whether, you know, it used to be like leather seats or like heated seats. Now it's like, oh, could I have one CD player installed, please?
So the formats might continue to evolve, but I think one of the things that has stayed constant over the last decade is the continued interest of young readers. We have talked a little bit before about millennials as library users, and it may seem strange, but it turns out the biggest users of public libraries today are millennials. A national analysis from the Pew Research Center found that 53% of millennials, so people aged 18 to 35, have used a public library or bookmobile within the last 12 months. That's more than the Gen Xers, the baby boomers, and then the people, I think they're calling the silent generation, age 71 to 88. Hmm. So what we know about the last decade of reading is that people still read a lot of really great books. Mm-hmm. And so I think we should talk about some of the ones that were our favorites from the last decade. There are lists all over the place right now. If you do kind of Google search, you know, best books of the decade, everybody is coming out with a list. And we kind of compiled our own little list. And looking at our list of things that have been popular at the Sioux City Public Library, we've done actually a lot of checkouts for a lot of those books on that list. So books like Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, mm-hmm. Me Before You by Jojo Moyes, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. By the way, that was one of my favorite books on this list, and she has a new book coming out this year, and I am totally excited to read it. I had to take a screenshot. Here's how I use my technology. I took a screenshot of the promotion that I saw online so that I can remember and come to the library and check it out.
That's how I use my technology. It's the new Post-it note.
It is. That's my screenshot was my technology, so I can make sure to get on the list for her new book.
Of course, The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, The Widow by Fiona Barton,
Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, They're There by Tommy Orange, The Great Alone by Kristen Hanna. Of course, we mentioned Where the Crawdads Sing already by Delia Owen, a book that I recently did a check it out for, City of Girls by Elizabeth Gilbert, and then one of the ones that made our NPR concierge was Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb. And of course, I have a little personal bias to both of those because I love both of those books.
I think that's fair.
We would be remiss if we didn't mention that the very first check it out book that we featured was on the best books of a lot of the best books of the decade list. Do you know what that was?
I don't.
It was The Martian by Andy Weir. That was the first book that the Sioux City Public Library reviewed for its Check It Out series, which is actually approaching its 5-year anniversary.
Wow. So. That is really embarrassing that I didn't know that, but I think it's fair
because
I wasn't here then.
You were not
it predates
here then.
Me.
Yes.
It predates me, so I'm not going to feel that much guilt about it.
Also on this list that we've compiled, there are a lot of books that the library selected for Open Book Club.
So some of our, you know, my personal favorites that we've done for Book Club were we read The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrecht, The Paris Wife by Paula MacLean, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest by Cheryl Strayed, The Light Between Oceans by M.L. Stedman. We also read Hillbilly Elegy for a book club book. We did Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. So some of these were, you know, open book club titles, but also books that the Western Iowa Tech Lifelong Learning Book Club did as well. And we have a really great partnership with them that we help kind of provide them with reading recommendations. You know, if you'd liked a certain part of a book that they've read, you know, maybe it was that you liked the subject matter, or you liked that it was lyrical writing, or that it maybe was a very fast-paced story, that, you know, the library has been hopefully helpful to them in that way, that if you really liked a specific part, that we are able to offer you some additional books to read.
And then there were some books, I think, that when we look back over the last decade, that maybe weren't the best literature, but, you know, like we talked about with Gone Girl, had huge influence. And you mentioned one of those at the very beginning of our podcast. I think you can't talk about the last decade without mentioning The Hunger Games trilogy by Suzanne Collins. It's a young adult or teen book series, and it really was this crossover phenomenon when it was published. Everyone was reading the series, even grandparents, you know, like from high elementary school up to grandparents were all mm-hmm. asking for The Hunger Games. And there was a lot of excitement when Mockingjay came out in this last decade. That was the last book in the trilogy.
So we'd kind of be remiss if we didn't mention, you know, any books that really kind of surprised us that, you know, they were on this list. And for me, probably the book that surprised me, which we actually did it for book club, was Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. I remember just being like, oh god, I really didn't like this book. And it kind of surprised me because usually I've enjoyed the books that, you know, maybe Oprah's recommended or, you know, other like big name celebrities where I'm like, all right, I'll give that a chance.
That book did have the, you know, kind of Oprah seal of approval. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I don't know if he was in an interview or he tweeted about it, but President Obama said that that was one of his favorite books that he had read the year that it came out. So a lot of people were interested in it. I think it was just a tough story, again, like unlikable characters, in a challenging story.
I mean, I didn't have enough like life experience to get it that it was, you know, about a marriage and all of the stuff that I was just like, that's not really.
Yeah, but there was definitely a lot of interest, and it made a lot of best book lists for the year that it came out, for sure.
Yeah, was there a book that surprised you, Jen?
One that I saw over and over on book lists, and I was like, really? Like, I almost had to like try and remember the book, was A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. And she's had a few other books published in the last decade that I think had some popularity, but for some reason, that book just surprised me because we didn't have a huge push for it, for, you know, people wanting to read it. And so I decided that I was actually going to read this book. And so I started it. And I think one of the interesting things so far that I'm gathering from this book is that it does talk about the escalation of technology and its impact on our society.
I wouldn't necessarily get that from the title.
Yeah. So, yeah, with that, I don't want to like ruin it or give any spoilers.
Give me spoilers.
But one of the things that it talks about, so 10 years ago, we probably didn't text everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's, you know, one of the kind of things that it points out in the book. And it's not really a dystopian novel, but it says that young adults will prefer essentially texting over talking as kind of one of those, they said, creepily plausible themes. I'm like, well, that's the truth. and it's, you know, kind of come to pass. So I don't know if it was just sort of those themes that pulled it onto that best book list, but it's not a book I would normally pick, but it is literary fiction, psychological fiction. It's character driven, so I'm actually listening to it as an audiobook. I'm probably about 3 hours in, so I think I'll finish it. But I don't know if it's one that I'm going to really necessarily recommend.
And, you know, kind of in looking at all these different lists, you know, we always kind of think about, like, was there a book that, you know, you always meant to read and didn't? Or, you know, one that you, like, put in a notebook, like, yeah, I'm going to write that down. And, you know, just it never happens. For me, that book is Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders. I know he's been recommended to me by a ton of different friends, and I just keep being like, oh yeah, like I'll read him later, you know, whatever. And finally, like, I have the book. I checked it out. Like, I'm gonna read it.
We both have our guilt reading, don't we?
Yeah.
Lincoln and the Bardo, it was on a lot of best of lists for the year it was published. And it did have, I think, a surprising popularity, but I think because a lot of book clubs were reading it too. I think that was, you know, usually there is always a push in popularity when book clubs pick up a book, for sure. I think the one that I'm committing to read, because I just think I have to read Gone Girl. So that is my going to be my New Year's resolution. I am going to read Gone Girl in the next decade, of course. But I will have missed the trend, but I think I have to experience the story. Because of all the talking that we've been doing about, I'm like, I just have to read it and experience it for myself.
You have to experience the original, like, unreliable narrator.
I've kind of forgotten how it ends, too, so nobody spoil it for me, please.
So if you see her on the street, don't talk to her about it.
It has been really fun, I think, to look back on the last decade, just from our own experiences in the library, our own experiences with reading.
Just kind of, you know, how much everything has changed from 2010 to now going in to 2020. That still seems crazy to say that it's going to be 2020.
But here we are. So my recommendation is just keep reading. Keep reading, keep using your library.
Whatever format you prefer, there is no shame. Whether it's audiobooks like we talked about in our last podcast episode, or whether it's ebooks like we've talked about before, or you still like a good old-fashioned print book, like Jen said, just keep reading. This is Kelsey.
And this is Jen.
And thank you for listening to the first 50 pages.